Timothy chapter 1. If you're a visitor, we have been in a new series on 1 Timothy. We began it 2 weeks ago, so you missed the introduction and you missed the exegesis on verses 1 through 7. In those studies, summarizing those studies, we found that there were false teachers teaching in the church at Ephesus, and that the Apostle Paul, somewhere between his two imprisonments, discovered this, couldn't stay at Ephesus, but left Timothy there so that Timothy would straighten out some of the mess that was caused by the false teachers. Some of the emphases of these false teachers are described in verses 3 through 6. We found that they taught false or spurious doctrine. That would be in contrast to the doctrine that Paul taught. We found that they emphasized fable myths, that they stressed pedigrees and genealogies. We found that their aim was wrong. Hence, doctrinally, they turned in a wrong direction. The result of their ministry was speculations and empty prattling. In verse 7, we found some of the bases for the problem that these teachers had subjectively. The King James says they desired to be teachers of the law. In other words, they wanted to be law teachers. Now, what you have in that verse, again, this is part of the summary from last time. They were wishing to be law teachers, and you have this participle, this present active philontes, which expresses great desire. This is great emotional desire. Okay? And this happens to be a present active participle. And the present tense simply means the action of that participle was durative. Their desire to teach the law was not just some passing fancy. It was continual with them. They wanted to put their emphasis on the law. Now, apparently they were Jewish, or at least they were Jewish-oriented, most likely Jewish. And there was great status in being recognized as a law teacher among the Jews. This was actually a profession that they were gunning for. And in that day, that profession was very much looked up to. However, the problem in the gospel, the problem that this brings to the gospel is to place an improper and undue emphasis in one place. They were going to grind an axe, see, with the law. Okay? Okay, there's nothing wrong with wanting to know what the law says, but wanting to use it as an axe in the church, that's wrong because the emphasis will be in the wrong place. So, this is a participle of cause. If you're a Greek student, it is because they were wishing to be law teachers that they turned aside, they turned out of a proper doctrinal path, and they ended up in vain jaggling, empty prattling, as verse 6 tells us. There are actually two participles here that are very interesting. This is a participle of cause, and hence you could translate it because desiring to be law teachers. Now, those of you who know something about Greek would be interested to know that this to be is the infinitive einai, which comes from eimi. They desire to be looked upon in their essence as law teachers. See, this is an essence verb, eimi. It's the infinitive form. And in their status quo essence, the image that they wanted to portray to other human beings was that they were great authorities on Mosaic law. Okay? Now, because of that, they turned aside, even though, then the next participle is a participle of concession, even though not understanding. Paul is really laying them low here. Because desiring to be law teachers, even though not understanding what they say, nor what they affirm categorically. They don't understand it. We said last week, in the 20th century vernacular, it means they didn't know what the hell they were talking about. Okay? Even though, this verb here means the use of the mind, the comprehension in what we are saying, what they are affirming. And they didn't use that. They didn't know what they were talking about. Okay, now that's right where we left off last week. That ends a little bit the description of these false teachers and some of what they were teaching. Now, because this is true, because they do not understand what they say nor what they affirm, then they misused and misapplied the law. Got it? They probably made even adumbrations to it. They probably added to the law. But because they did not understand it, that's very critical that you understand that they didn't understand. Because now Paul is going to have to straighten out the real purpose of the law in the minds of the people at Ephesus. See? And he's going to try to do that through Timothy. Because they didn't understand it, then we have a natural consequence of this is, hence, misuse and abuse of the law. And the law here is very definite. It has an article in front of it in verse 7, desiring to be teachers of the law. See, this has to be a Mosaic law. Okay. Now, apparently, and I think you're going to see this as we go on, at least I hope you do, the part of the Mosaic law that they were misapplying was the moral law. The moral aspects of the law was being misused of this, and I think you'll see that before we're done. All right, let's take up with verse 8 then. We're going to try to cover verses 8 through 11 this morning. Okay, in verse 8, Paul now reverts to his own thinking and the men that he trained, Timothy and so on. But we know. And the verb there for know is the verb that means we know categorically on the basis of fact. Not experience. Verse 8. But we know. This is the verb oida. Oida, O-I-D-A, is a perfect tense. It's one that's used in the present sense, however. It's one of those verbs that degenerated from classical Greek and is used in the present sense in the Koine Greek. We know. This is to know on the basis of facts. To know absolutely. On the basis of facts. Okay, we know on the basis of facts that the law is good. Again, we have the article with law. See, it's indicative that he's speaking of a law system that is clear in the minds of all the people. It could be nothing else but the Mosaic law. And he's saying this law is intrinsically good, and it's apparently good. It's not only good on the outside, but it's good on the inside. But a man has to use it lawfully. See? We know the law is good. And then he qualifies that if anyone uses it lawfully. Now, this word lawfully means, this has to mean from divine viewpoint. In other words, those who do not know the divine viewpoint of the Mosaic law will misuse it and abuse it. So it has to be used from the divine viewpoint, from God's purposes. From God's purposes. In giving of the law. From God's perspective in the giving of the law. From God's application of the law, etc. See? From all the divine viewpoint in the giving of the law. Now that would be to use the law lawfully. To use the law the way God intended, in other words. Okay. Now, what he's saying is you can misuse it and you can abuse it. And that is what these men were doing. Okay. Now he has a fantastic statement. Just absolutely fantastic. Verses 9 and 10. Knowing this, That's interesting. Yeah, he uses the, again, he uses a participial form of void on after knowing. Knowing this, this is categorical now, that law, no article, but has to be referring to the same thing, and hence you can properly supply the word the, but the law is not made for a righteous man. Well, so one of the divine perspectives in the law, two divine perspectives in the law here. Two divine perspectives in the law, or purposes, or viewpoints. And the law that is spoken of here is the moral law of God. One, it is not for the righteous man. Now wait a minute, who is the righteous man? This word, righteous man, is the word dikaios, D-I-K-A-I-O-S, which simply means a justified man. A man who is declared righteous before God. That's what a righteous man is. In other words, the law was not written to change your mode of conduct. It wasn't given for that. We're going to see that before we're done. And anybody who is declared righteous in Jesus Christ, that law is not for him. It wasn't written for him. It was written for another category. And that other category is the one he dwells upon. This justified man, of course, is a believer in Jesus Christ. Now, we throw these, you know, we who understand these terms, we who are oriented to the word dikaios in all of its forms, the verb form, the noun form, the adjectival form, we throw that word around loosely, and I don't know how it grabs you. I think sometimes we get so familiar with it, it doesn't grab us enough. I want to tell you something. If you're an unsaved person here this morning, that is a fantastic word. That means that any person who is a believer in Jesus Christ has Jesus Christ's righteousness, absolute righteousness, imputed to him, put to his account. And this person is looked upon from the divine viewpoint as being righteous, just as righteous as Jesus Christ is righteous. Now, that's good news. 2 Corinthians 5:21 says, He, meaning God, hath made him, meaning Jesus Christ, God hath made Jesus Christ to be sin for us, he who knew no sin, that we might be made the righteousness of God in him. You do not become righteous in God's eyes by changing your forms of conduct. Well, I went down to that church down there, and I noticed nobody smoked down there. They all smell so nice. So I'll quit smoking. That's plus one in God's eyes, I guess. Now, what else should I quit? Well, I noticed they don't all swear too much. Not too much. At least I haven't heard them. That sounds pretty good, so I'll quit swearing. Plus two. Start stacking up all your goodies, trying to make yourself righteous in God's eyes. Well, the unfortunate thing about that thing is you can stack the rest of your life and you'll never hack it. You can't build up enough human righteousness to equate to the kind of righteousness that God is. See, God has a plan in which He has destroyed any form of human righteousness as creating a standard before Him. And the whole world misses the point there. See, they say, well, here's God, and here's man. And most of them are willing to admit that they're some kind of a sinner. I mean, you know. But here is an ascending plane up to God, and here's the way they think. Well, let's see. All the prostitutes and crooks and thieves are down here on this level. And if you don't cheat too much, then you're here. And then if, let's say you really want to reach up here, well, then you sort of, you go to church every week, and they're up here. And then up here is, here's Mahatma Gandhi. He sat around and looked holy all the time and was a pacifist, so he must be a good guy. He looked like he never got mad at anybody. He really must be super. Or Albert Schweitzer. Albert Schweitzer was a liberal. He was a lost man. He had four earned PhDs by the time he was about 32. Albert Schweitzer was a liberal. He didn't know who Jesus Christ was from Adam. There's a friend of mine down in Englewood. She's an old lady. She and her husband, as a very young couple, went to Ippi in the Belgian Congo when they were young persons. They were missionaries. And they just stayed in Ippi all their life. 30 years later, he died. She lived. She stayed there 10 more years, and then she retired. They built a work. The Lord used them to build a work. Fantastic work in the heart of the Belgian Congo. You probably never heard of it. She received the Legion of Merit from France. And when the French ambassador to the Belgian Congo was putting the Legion of Merit around her neck, he said in her ear, he said, "Your work would make Albert Schweitzer's place look like a kindergarten." But you never heard of her. If you ever get to hear her speak, you want to do it. She doesn't preach because she knows that's not the woman's role. She just tells you what happened in her life and lets it go at that. She's a fantastic person. Well, the human viewpoint is that all these are these little righteousness things. If you add them all up somewhere, they balance out the scales and God's going to accept you. Well, God has destroyed that as a system of acceptance. The only thing that bridges the gap between man and God is the death of Jesus Christ. Here's man, here's God, and here is the cross, and here is plus R laying down itself, taking upon itself this sin of mankind. And God, in fact, God took this sin and laid it on plus R. You don't even have the capacity to lay it on plus R. God did it. And he's destroyed all these human works types of. So the law, which demands a certain code, a certain form of conduct, the law says to you, you don't do this and you don't do that. The law wasn't given to force you to change your conduct. Because in changing your conduct, it still doesn't do you any good. It is telling you some right conduct from divine viewpoint. Yes, it is. Yes, it is. It's always been wrong to steal. It's always been wrong to commit adultery. It's always been wrong to lust. It's right not to do those things. The law wasn't given to get you in your mentality by some human effort to change your conduct. The law was given to expose your conduct and show you what you are. So, in trying to straighten out what these false teachers had, the unrest over the law that they had caused, Paul has to straighten them out on the use, the proper use from divine perspective of the law. He says, know this first, that the law is not made for the righteous man. He has something far superior to that. He will have God himself dwelling actually in him. Okay, it is not made for the righteous man. So we have these two divine perspectives or purposes of the law. Two lawful ways of using the law. One, not for the righteous man, not for those in Christ. All right, secondly, it is, by the way, the word made there is the word, I'm messing up the notes. That's just SOP for me, but the word made there, it means laid down, placed down, set down. It's not made in the sense of constructing something. It means something that is categorically set down in black and white, and you can look at it. God set down his moral law in black and white, and we still have it today, and we know what it is. And he set that down not for the righteous man, but for these people who fit this other category. So we have then on this side, the law is set down or placed or fixed for. Now we have 15 various categories of persons, okay, that are mentioned. The first six of these categories, they're joined by the conjunction chi, and then the rest of them are just singular, okay? Latter part of verse 9. But the law is made for the lawless. Okay, so we'll put the article here, and then we'll begin to list these 16 types for which the law was constructed. Small a, number 1, the lawless. Now the lawless, here we have anomos. A-N-O-M-O-S. Nomos means law. Alpha prefix negates it. It means no law. A no-law type person is a person who will not recognize legal obligation to God. Okay? So this is one who recognizes no responsibility toward God. In other words, he totally disregards any personal responsibility to the true and the living God. I have found this to be a very good point to begin with when you witness to a person. Do you believe there's a God? Yeah, I do. You nearly always get that responsibility, that response. Well, then you can. There's various. You know, there is no set formula for witnessing. You know, you play it all by ear. If you've ever done any witnessing, you know that. But I have found it good to try to deal with human responsibility toward God. If there is a God, do we have any responsibility to Him? Well, I don't know. I do the best I can. Well, what is the best? How do you define best? How do you define God? What is our relationship, you see? Well, this person who is lawless in terms of his responsibility toward God, the law is made for him. You can use the law on that person. You can say, well, haven't you heard that God said this and this and this? Now, how do you equate yourself against that, see? Okay, now this word, lawless, is joined to the second one by the conjunction chi, and so it means that these two go together. The King James translates the next one, disobedient. The law was made for the lawless and disobedient types. Now, this person is contumacious. How do you like that word? Yeah. This person is insubordinate. This is the kind of person that needs to be put in the military to get him straightened out. I picked up a Marine this week. It was just exciting to me. I was coming down. I usually don't pick up hitchhikers. But I was coming down Mississippi, and this guy wasn't hitchhiking. You know what he had? He had a duffel bag, and he had a suit hanger type bag. And he had them in one hand over his shoulder, and the duffel bag was full. And in the other hand, he had two handbags. And he was walking down from past Heather Gardens down toward Havana, out where those grain fields are still there. And he was just walking down the road. And I went flying by him, and I thought, boy, I couldn't forget the time that I was in the service, and I had a duffel bag and a set of golf clubs. I was sort of the worldly military type. Kind of destroy my story. But anyhow, I had two bags, and I was shipped out real quick. And I had to throw all that stuff in and try to make it to another base. And I had to ride a train and a bus. Oh, was it? Anyhow, I backed all the way up and picked that guy up. Nice short haircut, clean shaven. I said, "How do you like the Marines?" He says, "I like it." I said, "That's good." I said, "What do you like about it?" He says, "I like the discipline." So I needed it. It was good for me. Young kid. Just got out of high school last year. Been in for a year. He didn't complain. He didn't issue one complaint. I says, "Where are you going?" He says, "Well, I'm on my way to California." And he says, "The car I had wouldn't start this morning." He says, "So I just had to get to the bus station. So I'm trying to find a bus." Not one complaint. I thought, boy, how fantastic in this age. He didn't gripe, he didn't complain, he didn't swear all over the place. I rode him to a place where he could get a bus. This disobedient person is really one who will not subject himself to authority. This is a person who refuses subjection to God. Now that is the difference between these two. See, one who will not recognize responsibility. Here is one who says, well, there's some responsibility, but I refuse it. These two go together. The law is written for that person. It's going to condemn him. It's going to get to him. And you can use it that way. Okay? All right. The third one. Again, these next two are joined by ungodly, and sinners. C and D. These two joined by the conjunction chi. Okay? Now, what is an ungodly person? This is the word asebes. Asebes. A-S-E-B-E-S. Well, asebes is if all of these are mental attitudes. Every one of these. Lawless type person, disobedient type person, asebes, and so on. These are all mental attitudes. Asebes person has a mental attitude of deliberate, an M-A of deliberate irreverence to God's person. This is the socialist in his literature, and the kind of literature he's pushing off on the public schools. That's an asebes person. He disrespects what God has revealed about himself, and hence he will make fun of what Christians say God is like, and he'll do it in his literature. And the literature squabble that you read about in West Virginia is not just a matter of a bunch of ignorant hillbillies. That literature squabble happened to be going on in North Carolina, in South Carolina, in New Jersey, in Connecticut. It went on in Jefferson County when I lived in Jefferson County, and I was involved in it. The kind of literature they were going to use in the public schools. A sebes person is one who has a mental attitude of deliberate irreverence to God's person. Now, the word sinner is one who missed the mark. One who misses the mark in his mind. He may, and then this expresses itself overtly. He misses the mark God has set for man. He comes short of it. Okay? All right, those two go together. All right, now E and F go together. The next two. Unholy and profane. All of these expressions are characteristics of persons to whom the law is directed. The word unholy looks like this. Anosios. Well, nosiois, you're looking at the dative locative instrumental case, so you have that ending, S-I-O-I-S, if you're looking at one of the interlinears. Now, some words, when you prefix them, if they start with a vowel, to negate the word, then you have to add this little N in here also. So this means not. And hosios is the word that we translate holy or sanctified, which really means set apart. An unholy person is one who is not set apart. He has not been set apart by God in Jesus Christ. This means a non-sanctified one. A non-sanctified. And then that will be manifested by an impiety. He is impious. Using pious in the good sense. Not the super sank sense, but the good sense. Now that person generally is all, these two go together, and that person then is generally profane about the things of God. Profane simply means that he has disrespect. He disrespects reverential attitudes toward God. This comes from a word, this word profane comes from a word that means to tread on the threshold. It means to walk upon something or to step upon it. And then it comes to mean to disregard. This person makes fun of Christians' reverential attitude toward God. The profane person, the biblios person. The asebes person, he makes deliberate irreverence toward God's essence itself. this person makes disrespectful remarks relative to believers and their attitudes toward the word, Lord. Well, the law is made for this type of person. All six of these, hang in here now, all six of these express mental attitudes. See? These all express the mental attitude of unbelievers. Now, that does not mean that all unbelievers disrespect your reverential attitudes for God. It doesn't mean that all unbelievers concentrate on any one of these issues or all of them. It just means that this is the potential of unbelievers, and the law is made for those. Okay? Let's keep going. The seventh one, we'll call it letter G, and the eighth one go together. For murderers of fathers and murderers of mothers. Now, these are our words, G and H. These two go together. These are words that relate to parricide and matricide. Parricide in the ancient world and matricide, this would be a murder of a father, parricide, murder of a mother. I guess this would be the old effects complex run to the nth degree where you bump them off. But it really came to mean any type of disrespect toward the parents or unnatural treatment of the parents. It could be smiting to murder of parents. I'm wondering if Paul had in mind Nero when he wrote this. Because you see, he's writing in the time of Nero, and Nero has already killed his mother. He's killed his teacher, Seneca, and he's killed all members, he's killed his wife, had his wife murdered, and he killed all members of his family that were any threat to him in the emperorship. And when I read this, I couldn't help but think, I wonder if Paul had Nero in mind here when he talks about things. Well, it would have to do with anybody who, smoked or, showed disrespect in a violent way toward their parents. Letter I, the ninth one, is for murderers. Well, that's just, we know what that is. Somebody who violently takes life, who has such a disrespect for life that they take it with violence, and hence their life is to be taken from them violently. The tenth one, letter J. Now, the King James translates that one, whoremongers. Whoremongers. That's a pretty good word. This is really the word porn, it comes from pornia. Let me look at it. I have it spelled wrong, I think, when I wrote it down. I want to show you this word because I think that the implications of it are vast. Whoremonger is a good translation. Pornois. P-O-R-N-O-I-S. Pornois type people. This comes from the word pornia. Now, this word is really the word, this is the word fornicators. Okay? Now, what is a fornicator? A fornicator is a sexually loose person. Fornication covers a multitude of sins. It can include the sin of adultery. It can include the sin of sodomy. It can include the sin of homosexuality. It can include a lot of types of sins. It's a very generally loose term. Okay? Now, he follows this one by the sin of sodomy. Watch. And he's saying the law. Yeah, I just can't. The King James translates this next one word, them that defile themselves, them that defile with mankind. I want to show you this word. The law is made for these type of persons. This word is arsen coites. Well, you have the ois ending because it's the dative locative instrumental case. Okay, arsena koitois. Okay, arsene, this verb here, means meal. Okay, this word koitos, which comes from koite, is our same word for coitus, or sexual intercourse. This means sexual intercourse with a male with a male, which is sodomy. So he could have the King James could have translated this in one word, sodomite. Okay? All right. The law is made for those people. Why is the law made for this type of person? Because the law categorically and emphatically sets down in black and white, is placed, is fixed, to show the categorical moral imperative that God has for mankind. And when man sets himself up against that law, it destroys him. Or it makes one who is agitated more agitated. Or one who is at unrest, it makes him more at unrest when he sees God looking at him in this light. And then when God presents the answer to these problems in the gospel of Jesus Christ, that person is ready for the gospel if he hears what the law is saying. That's why the law is made for this. There are several lists in the Pauline epistles of sexual sin. Homosexuality, bestiality, sodomy, sexual perversion, lesbianism. There are several lists of these in the Pauline epistles. Isn't it interesting, in 1975, in the United States of America, it's tragic, but it's interesting, that our society is having trouble defining what is pornography, what is pornographic, and what is not pornographic. The courts find it totally impossible. Or should I say the courts, should I say the judges find it impossible? The problem is with the judge, not with what is pornographic and what isn't. God sets down categorically, emphatically, moral imperatives, and they're very clear in his perspective what they are. Yet in our day, they claim they can't define pornography. The police seem to be able to do it. They've had many attempts in Denver to shut down some of these XXX movies. And the police bring the evidence, but the courts throw it out. I sat down this week, and I just, out of the last 2 weeks, of news. I'll illustrate this. And I just kept writing and writing. In our state, we had a primary school teacher. I don't recall the name of the town. I think it was in one of the southern towns. She was teaching either the fourth grade or the sixth grade, and she decided she'd have a board, special blackboard set up for a graffiti board for obscenities in her classroom. So she blocked off this one board, and nobody was to write on there except any of the kids that wanted to write some stuff that they usually write on the John wall. They could write it there in the classroom. And there were just obscenities written all over that thing. So the principal found out about it, came in, looked at it, emptied the classroom, locked the door, took photographic evidence of it, presented it to the school board, and they fired her. Now she's suing the principal and the school board because they violated her academic freedom. And I wouldn't be surprised if she won the case. I read a week ago that now they're trying to get pornographic movies on the airline. Their big hang-up is the children that ride. How are they going to get around that? They said, don't worry, we'll figure a way. I clipped an article last week from a church magazine. The name of this article is Changing Attitudes Towards Sexuality. The point of the article is that there are new changing mores in the United States, and we all have to rethink this thing about sexual perversion, because the perverts really, they're probably not too perverted. And they don't want to use that. Now listen to what this article says. I'll read you one paragraph. This is out of a church magazine. To look at sexuality from a psychiatric and psychological point of view is to be in a rather dangerous position today, in that the psychiatric field is going through quite a revolution in its own thinking and in its own beliefs. In fact, if you have read any textbooks in psychiatry or psychology lately, you can plainly see that such an evolutionary change, interesting thing, has taken place over the past 10 years. For instance, 10 years ago, in the clinical textbooks, homosexuality was listed under perversion. A few years ago, it came under, quote, deviation. And just in last year's copy of some major textbooks, homosexuality was listed under, quote, variation. So, 10 years ago, a homosexual was considered a pervert. Then they softened the term to a deviant. He's just sexually deviant. He doesn't walk in the same trend you do, but he deviates from it a little bit. Now it's called a variation. It's the same thing, just a variant of heterosexual relationships. And the book actually advocates, this article actually advocates, and it does it on the basis of statistics. It says, for instance, according to reliable national studies, be careful of those. 60% of American males engage in some kind of homosexual activity, including genital play before puberty. Between adolescence and the age 45, 37% of males have had at least one homosexual encounter leading to orgasm. That's more than one in three, the writer of the article inserts in brackets with an exclamation point. And then he goes on to quote, 50% of the men said their sexual experience was totally heterosexual, blah, blah, blah. And what he's doing there is saying, everybody's doing this, and that makes it right. If we're going to determine a norm, we have to determine it by what everybody's doing. That, after all, that is the scientific method, isn't it? Observe, record, come to a conclusion. And under this empirical evidence, everybody does it, and then we establish a norm. Does anyone wonder that God has to reach down out of heaven with his own hand and write on a rock and say, this is it? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. This is it. And then he preserves it through time, space, history. And he keeps coming at you and saying, this is it! This is it! And deviations from this are wrong and harmful and evil. Period. Doesn't matter if 99.99% practice deviation or variance. You know, there's a new movie coming out. Al Pacino is in it. The fellow that starred in The Godfather. I'm telling you this now because the psychological effect of the media, the news media, the arts, the sciences, not so much the sciences, but the arts, the psychological effect of those is overwhelming now. They're making a new movie now. It's about three or four gay people, persons from, I didn't want to call them men, from Brooklyn, that robbed the bank. This was a true happening. They robbed the bank, and one of the persons got killed, and happened to be this other guy's lover, the one that sent to jail. And they're making a movie out of it. And Al Pacino plays one of the lead roles in it. You know what they did? They took the script of that movie to the president of the gay liberation movement, or society, or whatever it is, and they got him to read it, and they wanted him to approve it before they made the movie. They said if he wouldn't approve it, they wouldn't make the movie. Because they, after they make their movie about these four gays, they don't want the gay liberation movement coming out against the movie. So they might lose money that way. Well, I want to tell you, the sex and the violence in the arts and the media, what it's saying to everybody is, let's all move down to the level of the ghetto. You poor people live in the suburbs, you just don't have all the blessings of the ghetto. Now let's convert everybody to ghetto language and ghetto thinking. Where in the world is our mentality in this country? Swearing profusely in movies now, just, it's sick. And instead of raising people's sights, they pull everybody down. Well, God says, these are my standards. Now you put yourself up against those standards and you're going to fall short. And prepare you for the gospel. I want to tell you something. There are homosexual people that are Christians. And I've known several. I've dealt with several. But I've never known a one that was a Christian that didn't recognize the evil of it and he wanted to be cured. So don't get confused by what the media comes at you with in the days ahead in this country. And don't think that those people that are fighting for the education of their children in West Virginia are a bunch of clucks. They're not. The textbooks they're fighting show Biblios persons, Asabiah type persons, disrespect God, tear him down very subtly. And their socialistic textbooks that they foster in the schools. And the issue there is, do parents have the right in this country to determine what kind of education their children get, or have we gone that far that the state will determine what kind of education my child will get? Well, when we get that far, you know where we are, don't you? We're right next door to Russia. Parents don't have a right to educate their children in Russia. Parents don't have a right to teach their children any religious mores, any concept of God. They can't do it. It's against the law. Well, I'll get all stirred up here. Paul says that the law was written for these type of people. The law is not going to force upon them a change of conduct. It wasn't written for that. And we're coming to that in just a minute now. Okay. Sodomite. Very clear term in the Greek language. Okay. He goes on in his list. L. Number 12. Men stealers. These, of course, in Paul's day would probably be slave traders, or it could be anybody who exploits. Exploiters of men or women. It could be the concept of kidnapping applied generally. The next one, next term, liars. I guess we don't have to define that one. That ought to be clear enough. The next one, perjured persons. Perjured persons. Okay. Perjured person would be one who takes an oath falsely, an oath violator. Okay? It would be one then who would bear false witness, right? This would be a false witness. He perjures himself. Okay. Now, in case he missed any, he says this at the end of verse 10, and if there be any other thing that is contrary to sound doctrine, the law was written to silence that. Okay? Any other thing contrary. Now notice how he's going to describe his doctrine here. There's an article here. To the sound doctrine. And that means the kind that Paul had delivered to the Ephesian church. The word sound here really means healthy. If there be any other thing contrary to the healthy teaching. Okay? This healthy teaching was the Summa Theologiae of Paul, the doctrine of the Apostle Paul. And what a beautiful word he uses. The kind of teaching that I brought to you is going to correct all this perversion. It's going to straighten it out in the individual's mind. Okay. Now, the point was that the law was made for these. Now, watch. Let's go through these and sort of summarize these in relationship to the moral law. The moral law, of course, is that part of the Mosaic economy that we call the Ten Commandments. Now, you can take letters A through F, 1 through 6, of these. This business of lawlessness, disobedience, of ungodliness, of sinfulness, of unholiness, and of impiety, and you can apply them to the first four commandments. I don't have room on this overhead. Let me do it down here to the first six. Here you have A through F. And you have all of those categories of attitudes of persons listed together. They correspond to commandments number 1 through 10. Or 1 through 4, I'm sorry. Commandments that are listed in Exodus chapter 20. Numbers 1 through 4. And all of those relate to man's relationship to reverence toward God. For instance, the first commandment is, thou shalt have no other gods before me. I am the Lord, Jehovah Elohim, I am the Lord thy God. Thou shalt have no other gods before thee. Or before me, I'm sorry. You cannot exalt some concept, some spirit to the place of deity. That would be paganism. It takes my place. It usurps my authority. The second commandment says, thou shalt not make unto thee any graven images, which is an insult to God, to take God and reduce him to an image. The third one says, you shall not take the name of the Lord thy God in vain, in futility, to make the name of Jehovah Elohim a futile term. This is what an Asebase type person does. This is what a profane person does. This is what an impious person does. He reduces to the name of God to futility. Okay? The fourth one speaks of a day of reverence. Remember the Sabbath day. And keep it holy. Be reverent toward the Sabbath day. This, of course, was an Old Testament day of reverence toward God, set apart for him. For the believer, of course, every day is equally holy. There is no one day. Every day is a day of reverence. And to be respected, and to be served toward the Lord. So the first six of these categories relate to the first four of the moral law. All right, let's take up with parricide and matricide, which relates to disrespect to parents. This would be commandment number 5. Remember thy father and mother. Remember them in a sense of respect. Commandment to Israel, that thy days may be long upon the earth. The sixth one, murderers. The ninth one will equate to the sixth commandment. Thou shalt not murder ruthlessly. Thou shalt not kill ruthlessly. Thou shalt not show disrespect for life in a ruthless manner, that you take it ruthlessly. The idea there is murder. Isn't the idea of going to war, isn't the idea of killing in war, the same God that said to Israel, thou shalt not kill, the same God commanded them to go into the land and slay the Amalekites and so on. I mean that at all. The next one, whoremongers and sodomites, you see, is very applicable to the seventh commandment, which says thou shalt not commit adultery. Okay? The men stealers, liars, perjured persons, these could be considered, well, let's put this one down for number 8. And stealers, of course, would be, thou shalt not steal. The liars and perjured persons could be equivalent to number 9, thou shalt not bear false witness, see? And then this open one can be similar to the 10th commandment of the moral law, which is also an open commandment. Thou shalt not covet, inordinately desire, a man, a maidservant, male servant, nor ox, nor ass, or anything that is thy neighbor's. That's the idea. The law was not made, Paul is saying, for one who is in Christ, but it is made for other people, in that it brings them up against the standard that condemns their attitudes. And the law is not asking that they change their attitude so much as it is showing them their need for forgiveness from the Almighty God. And that forgiveness comes only through the gospel of Christ. And so Paul continues now. Look, watch how this fits together now. He concludes it in verse 11. Let me pick up the context. I'll start reading at verse 8. Notice that this is all one sentence in the King James. But we know, verse 8, that the law is good if a man use it lawfully from divine viewpoint, knowing this, that the law is not made or set down for one who is in Christ, the righteous man, but it is for the lawless and disobedient, for the ungodly and for sinners, for unholy and profane persons, for murderers or smiters of fathers and mothers, for murderers or manslayers, for whoremongers or sexually loose persons, for sodomites, for men-stealers or exploiters of mankind, for liars, for perjured persons, if there be any other thing that is confound doctrine, the law is made for them, according to the glorious gospel of the blessed God which was committed to my trust. Meaning, the use of the law for the ungodly is in accord with the gospel. And the gospel is the good news of what God has provided for sinful men. And it is through the gospel, through the fact that Christ died and bore the curse of the law, and through the fact that we also died with him, we who have believed, that we are no longer under the law, but we are now under God's grace. The law points out the absoluteness of God in relationship to man's sin. But the gospel points out the absolute forgiveness of God in relationship to man's sin, and provides man with a standing before God and with an essence, a change in essence, whereby his conduct will change. You see? Whereby his conduct and the spirit of the tenure of his life can be changed or molded into the image of God. And the gospel is the only thing that provides that. So Paul says, all of this that I'm saying is in accord with the gospel of the blessed God which was committed to my trust. Okay. The law was given to silence men as they are confronted with divine norms and standards. The gospel is the good news that Christ fulfilled the law, that he died under it, that he bore its curse and its penalty, so that believers in Christ can be accounted as righteous and having died with him. Next week we'll take right up with that statement that this is all in accord with the glorious gospel is not a good translation. I'm going to show you that next week. It's really, all of this is in accord with the gospel of the glory of the blessed God. Okay? Next week I want to show you a New Testament revelation on that moral law. What Paul says explicitly were its purposes. We'll go to the passages, and then we'll compact this verse, which says all of this is in accord with the gospel, so that we might gather some appreciation for that. Shall we thank God for this opportunity of having met together?